I had a friend in college. I mentioned a few years ago that I had had the opportunity to meet her again. And in college, she was a personal friend. In fact, I was best man when she was married to another friend of mine as well. And we did many things together as groups. And really, the memories I have are very personal and very fond. Serving God in the church, going to college, participating in the activities. And when I met her, and I had heard over the years, but not speaking to her directly, but I met her, and she no longer attended the Church of God. And so I sat down, and I just said, well, what was it? What happened? What was the difference? And I could ask her that. It wasn't a challenge. It was really a sincere request from a friend. And she said, well, you know, I never really felt clean. I mentioned this one time, but she said, I never really felt clean. And I've pondered that since she said that, trying to imagine what it was that she looked at in the church, how she saw God. I suspect that she saw God in a rather authoritarian way, that it was obedience and judgment and accountability, mainly without the tempering of the mercy and the kindness and the shepherding that also is there in place. A study came out recently from Baylor University, and they did an analysis over the last few years on how various people look at God, and they tried to break it down into different, what are the basic perceptions of God, and then they drew some conclusions from that. And they came out with four different basic perceptions of God. Now, I'm not saying this is the absolute, but it's material in some part that I thought had application to us. One, the main one that they talked about was authoritarian. God's authoritarian. Another group looked at God as mainly being benevolent. And then smaller portions look at God as being critical and distant. And critical and distant really don't count too much because God in those cases wasn't involved at all with his people. On the one hand, he was angry and not involved. On the other hand, he really didn't care and he was not involved. So they were drawing a comparison between whether or not God was angry and to what degree he was active or involved in people's lives. And so basically, when you have the authoritarian God, you have a God that is angry and involved. He's going to make you do what he said, and if you don't, you're going to pay. And the benevolent God was loving and kind and also involved. And he was there to nurture and to care and to encourage and to strengthen in a very personal way. Now, they also broke it down into political persuasions. Now, you can imagine, at some point, I have to wonder who drew up the survey. The angry, critical, judgmental God was the God of the conservative Republican base. And the kind, considerate, nurturing God was the God of the liberal Democrats. Now, I just said that's literally the political persuasion as they broke out. What a person's perception of God, how that impacted the decisions and choices that they then made. Again, the benevolent God is very compassionate and forgiving, full of love. Again, I can't say how much merit there is overall to the whole study. I do believe, though, that how we see God clearly impacts the relationship we have with him, and it heavily impacts the type of choices we then make. My friend from college said, I just never really felt clean. And in the end, she went to a place where the allowance for behavior and the conduct was such much broader and open and socially acceptable, and she says, I feel very good now where I am today. How we see God clearly impacts our relationship with him, and it also clearly impacts the type of choices we then make. What do you think the impact would be of seeing God primarily as an authoritarian figure? Matthew 25. There are scriptural examples, I think, that give us a little indication of what process then would play out in this way. Matthew 25 is the parable of the talents. I'm not going to read the whole parable because I think it is very familiar to us. I've used it in various times to teach. But in verse 24, you get down, you see, the person who had the 5 talents was very positive about what he could do with those things. He went out and invested it, so to speak, and there was increase. And he says, wow, I was excited. I did what you said, and look how it has produced. And so again, the one who had 2. But the one who had 1 talent said, verse 24, said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man. Now you could say, well, he knew, this is an analogy about God. It is a parable, but it's an analogy. And so what we're really looking at is what his own perception of God was. That wasn't the relationship of the man with the 2 talents, and that wasn't the relationship of the man who had the 5. It was the relationship here. He said, I knew in my own mind, you're a hard man, reaping where you've not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. A God of judgment, an authoritarian God who rebukes and punishes if you do not go his way. I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Look here, you can have what's yours. Here, take it back. His Lord answered and said, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown. God now, by analogy, has responded to him. All right, because of what you believed, then you should have at least been responsive to make fruit, to have increased, and you did not. Gather where I have not scattered seed, therefore you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers. And at my coming, I would have received back my own with interest. Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10. Everyone who has, more will be given. He will have abundance. From him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. Again, it does not indicate that the man with the 5 talents who has 10 would then look to God as a harsh and judgmental God. But God says, that's the way you see me. Indeed, that's the way it will be. The way that he saw God impacted both the relationship that he had with him and also the ways he responded to him. Exodus 3. We'll go back and look at Moses. Exodus 3. This is the account of the burning bush. It says, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert, came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, behold, the bush burned with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I'll now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to let, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, and he said, here I am. He says, do not draw near to this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That says, Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. I would have to say, so far, so good. To hide your face from the open and active presence of God would be to protect yourself in that way. But Moses' fear went far beyond just that. Notice God's instructions to Moses. Verse 10. He says, come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? He's responding in fear because he's looking at God in terms of his power only, in terms of his ability to execute and to bring judgment. That I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. He said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people up out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So God says, look, I will help you. I will care for you. I will provide for you. But Moses was still afraid. Chapter 4, verse number 1. Moses answered, well, suppose they don't believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say the Lord has not appeared to you. God says, well, I'll take care of that. I'll give you the ability. I will perform miracles through you. You can turn your rod into a snake. You can put your hand in your coat and bring it out, and it'll be leprous. You can put it back in and bring it out, and it will be clear. You can turn water, pour it out on the ground, and it will turn to blood. And Moses protested again, verse number 10 of chapter 4. Then Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before you nor since you have spoken to your servants, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. And the Lord said, who made man's mouth? Who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, and the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore, go. I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. Moses said, please, Lord, do something else. He's responding to God out of fear. He's not looking at the God of comfort. He's not seeing the God of mercy. He simply is responding out of fear. Please send by the hand of whoever else you may send. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. He says, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well, and look, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I'll be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people. He himself shall be as a mouth to you, and you shall be to him as a God. And you will take the rod in your hand, and with it you will do signs. So Moses is actually limiting here God's ability to exercise his power through him, to use him in that way. He drew back. Godly fear brings us closer to God in repentance. A spirit of fear pushes us away. It limits God's hand in our lives. Paul went to Timothy, encouraging him, he says, God has not given us a spirit of fear. So there are two kinds of fear. Godly fear strengthens us. Human fear causes us to draw back. When we look at God and experience human fear, we draw back. We pull away. It impacts our relationship with God, and it impacts the choices that we make. Look at Psalm 19. It is important in the way that we look at God. It's important what we understand about God, how we see God, and how we respond to him. Psalm 19 and verse number 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. How do we look at the law of God? Is the law a friend? Is the law a fence and a barrier that is a protector? Or is the law a barrier that keeps us from going where it is we want to be in some other place? Converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. Again, my friend said, you know, I never really felt clean. I look back and I had to say she had the wrong kind of fear. The wrong kind of fear. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. Now it follows, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter are also the honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. If you picture God as being primarily authoritarian, in that sense, he looks to you to be harsh, and that will change your relationship to him, and it will change the type of decisions you make in response. It appears, at least to me, that a large part of what drove Martin Luther to do what he did in terms of his focus on grace as compared to law and obedience, you know, the beginning or one of part of the beginning of what became the Protestant Reformation was his look at God, his view of God as a harsh taskmaster in that way. I used to think it was because he disagreed with the authority of the Pope. And he didn't like the fact that they were worshiping Mary and selling indulgences, get out of jail free cards. You know, the earliest version of Monopoly was an indulgence. And so I used to think that it was a matter of authority. Well, that's part of it. That as I read Karen Armstrong's book, A History of God, I managed to get it for $2.95. It says slight damage. It looks like it came through the Noachian flood. All the pages, you can hardly, they wrinkle up. But it had a quote in here from Martin Luther. And I thought it was interesting. He refers back to the way he lived his life when he was a monk in the Catholic Church. He says, although I lived a blameless life as a monk, I felt that I was a sinner with an uneasy conscience before God. I also could not believe that I had pleased him with my works. Far from loving that righteous God who punished sinners, I actually loathed him. I was a good monk, and I kept my orders so strictly that if ever a monk could get to heaven by monastic discipline, I was that monk. All my companions in the monastery would confirm this. And yet my conscience would not give me certainty. I always doubted and said, you didn't do that right. You weren't contrite enough. You left that out of your confession. So I go back, and there's a lot of history with Martin Luther. I hope in time to have time to study further some of the history that he left. But that shows a very clear guilt and conscience, and a look, a view of God that is primarily authoritarian. And it would appear to me, at least in part, that's what drove him then to cross the line and go completely another way, at least philosophically. So what happens then on the other side of that coin? What happens when we begin to see God primarily as benevolent? A benevolent figure, basically a God of soft love. You know what soft love is? Soft love is the tenderness and the kindness and the compassion. It's an important facet of love, but it's only part of love. I don't want to be like part of Christ. I want to be like as much of Christ as I can, which means both the tenderness, but also the firmness and the conviction. But what happens when we begin to see God primarily as benevolent? Well, the study said the first thing we have to do is register our political allegiance to the left side of the party. But I don't know. That's probably not going to affect many of us, one way or the other. Either side, to be honest. But we will respond in different ways. Now, I think where much of society responds is the law is done away. If you have a benevolent God, he becomes your buddy and your friend. And the whole purpose is to help or to assist or to do some kindness. And that equates with obedience, and so the law is done away. Now, I've addressed the law, we've addressed the law. I don't want to go there in this sermon because that would be going over, you know, replowing furrowed ground, so to speak. There is another element, though, that I think does affect us, and we see it in the book of Jonah. It's a little different than what we would possibly look at in the greater sense, the law being done away, but look at this in the book of Jonah. Now, give me some time. We're back into the minor prophets. There it is. I never know if I'm going to hit it. It's like counting my 12s. I never memorize my 12s. So I have to 12, 24, 36. I have to always count and start. So I never memorize my minor prophets. So I always start with Hosea. It's always nice to speak on one earlier in the group than later. It doesn't take quite as long. Jonah 3, verse number 10. I mean, it's only two pages here. Jonah's not a big book. We know the story. He goes out there, swimming around, gets swallowed by a big fish of some kind. God miraculously prepared. Doesn't have a very good ride. Goes back, decides to obey God. Warns Nineveh. Nineveh repents. Puts on sackcloth and ashes. Even the animals were put in sackcloth. And repents. And verse 10 of chapter 3 says, when God saw their works, that they returned from their evil way, and God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring on them, he did not do it. So now we have the fact that God exercises the compassionate side and says, you know what, these people have humbled themselves, and I'm not going to bring disaster on them at this time. Chapter 4. It displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. And he prayed to the Lord and said, Ah, Lord, was this not what I said while I was still in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Therefore now, Lord, please take my life from me. It is better for me to die than to live. Jonah didn't look at God as a harsh taskmaster, except that he didn't like the assignment he'd been given. He looked at God just the way it says. He was gracious, merciful, slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, and it really made him mad. In fact, it's stronger than the English version here translates, because when it says it displeased Jonah exceedingly, the literal translation of this is, it was evil to Jonah with great evil. So he's attributing to God now that this is wrong. This is not just, you know, this isn't just kindness and mercy. This is a mistake. It was evil with great evil, is the very literal translation of that passage. Jonah did not want God to spare a Gentile enemy nation. He wanted them destroyed. He wanted them to pay accountable, to be accountable for what they had done, for the destruction of his people, his brothers, Israel, for the oppression, for the judgment that had been brought, and the suffering that had been produced. He wanted them to answer. Loving our enemies requires us to go an entirely different way. But because of God's compassion and mercy, Jonah had a problem on the other side. Our teacher, our English teacher, the registrar when I was in college at Big Sandy was Dr. Torrance. Dr. Torrance was in the Philippines in World War II, and he was on Corregidor when it was captured by the Japanese. And he was on the Bataan Death March, and he was stuffed in one of the ships where they just locked up the portholes and the catch covers and sailed away to Japan. And so he went through the Death March when they would stab and kill and leave everybody behind. And he stomped his way along and survived to get into the ship. He was in the ship when they just absolutely locked it up without food and water and sailed to Japan. And you either lived or you didn't, and he lived. And he was in the prison camps in Japan when he spoke about the sickness and the labor and the dysentery. And I've heard, we would love it when he would fill in. I mean, he would fill in for class when somebody else was missing. And we loved it. And everybody would wait, and then we would do anything we could to get him off the subject of English. And we would ask, Dr. Torres, you know, what about this? And pretty soon he'd start telling stories. And we longed for that. But if you knew Dr. Torres, he was a congenial man. He didn't carry with him anger and bitterness. He didn't walk along wishing God would make judgment on the Japanese. God called him. He responded to that calling. God gave him the Spirit, and he bore great fruit. I sat with individuals, usually a man, if we're talking warfare, in the Church of God over the years, who despised those they fought against in the Pacific. To that day, they did. Now, I don't know if they didn't have God's Spirit. I don't know if they had never borne fruit. I don't know how deep and embedded some of those scars were, but the epithets at times that I heard referenced in regards to their opponents in the war were, even in smaller settings, sometimes openly expressed. I've seen it over and over. But I've seen people who are angry and bitter in other ways. Angry and bitter at a family member or a mate. Because God had not held them accountable in that way. That they had been prospered or blessed or had opportunity or in some way shown increase, and indeed they had not suffered and been punished for that which they had done. And I have seen people who are hurt, and I've seen them who are angry. How many people do you think shuddered when Paul was called into the church? Shuddered that he had been brought in there. People who had lost family members that were killed. And then Paul was called into the church. I'm sure there were people when he showed up that probably at least at first had to simply walk and turn the other way. They had to work their way through the anger and the pain and forgive and let it go before they could even be in his presence. And yet God called him. The merciful God called him. The compassionate God called him. But I'm sure that it was indeed a trauma for some. The death of Stephen has always been an amazing example to me. You know, Jesus Christ did it, but he's perfect and he's God in the flesh, and you know, he led the way. But it's when those who follow Christ indeed are able to bear the kind of fruit that he did and do it as he did in that way, it's also, to me, a remarkable thing. The death of Stephen is amazing. Now, in relationship to this, occasionally, and I don't mean just once every few years. I mean, occasionally, I get a question in regard to honoring our parents, where there have been problems in our family relationships, where there's been abuse, or maybe addiction, and there's resentment and stress, and there's struggle in our own emotions on how to process the relationship that way. And my advice is general. Wow, you could give a whole sermon on parts of this here. And I've often joked if we drive down, if we were going to Boise to speak, maybe I would. Just give me another 6 hours and I'd be there. That my advice in the most generic sense is, one, address your own anger. You got to go inside first. You have to address your own anger. And then, two, based on what the circumstances are, what type of abuse may have been, what kind of circumstances there were, then you need to use wisdom in deciding what level of contact can continue to be made. There are some people, literally, we have to protect ourselves from, but it doesn't mean in a parent that we can't still be honorable, respectful. We can't still have a relationship that follows God's purposes and principles He lays out in the Bible. But you see, what it is sometimes, again, because God is merciful and we haven't seen judgment executed and damage or injury has been done, then we walk around and carry this baggage ourselves. And you have to let it go. You know, my dad was an alcoholic. And I could go back and I could say, boy, I could tell you different members of my family who were abusive and took advantage in different ways, and we could look at what happened with the fact that he was in and out of institutions at times. Sure I can. But what for? Where does it go? Does it make me whole? Does it make me well? Does it make me happy? It doesn't make me anything except injured. And so I, by God's grace, when He called me into the church, and when I grew up, and my dad, because he had polio as well, he didn't have balance and strength in his core, and so you didn't sit in his lap. He never changed the diaper. He never tucked into bed. I can't remember anyone ever tucking me into bed. To this day, I have a phobia. I go to bed and there's nobody there to tuck me in. I'm joking. Not true. In fact, probably the disability I have, and Michelle would tell you, that's why I don't let her speak much. The disability I have is that it probably made me go the other way. I'm independent. You don't have to tuck me into bed. You don't have to help me out of bed. If you're not ready to get my meal, get it myself. I'm not saying that's my strength. I'm just saying that probably pushed me the other way. But I don't bear any resentment. I hope. I hope there's none there. It's not healthy for me in that way. But I don't look back and blame God for the fact that He didn't exercise judgment and correction and rebuke in that place. Parenting does have a relationship. The way a child looks at a parent is oftentimes the way that child is going to be taught then to look at God. That is the authority. Maybe more so even with the father, the male authority. Parenting has a relationship in the way the children come to look at God. Now, the same general grid that the Baylor study did, they talked about, it made like a square. I guess I did the square. I didn't see the square, but this is what they did. They had loving, and then they had angry, and then they had engaged and disengaged. And so, you know, when God was engaged in loving, there was one kind of God, and when God was loving but disengaged, there was another kind. And they had four different categories, basically. And I looked at that, and I said, well, you know, the terms are a little bit different, but that's the same basic grid I've seen used with parenting and types of parenting, the types of authority that's exercised as we raise our children as well. And there's various words that are used, and so I'll probably pick some that somebody had in their book that's copyrighted, but I honestly don't have one before me. The one I pulled and found and the one I couldn't find, which is a book on my shelf, has different words. But with parenting, you can do the same thing. You can say the parent is either loving or inattentive. And then you can say the parent is either strict or permissive. And you do a little four-square grid. And across the top is loving and inattentive, and down the side is strict or permissive. The best possible suit for raising children is a loving, strict parent. That's like God. It's justice and mercy mixed in together. The worst possible combination is to be permissive and inattentive. Allow your children to do whatever they want and don't pay any attention at all. That is a disaster and produces the worst problems as a whole in our social structure. Look at Proverbs 29 and verse number 15. I'm bringing this in because, again, the way we look at authority impacts the relationship to that authority. And it impacts choices we make in response to that relationship. And children will tend to look at their parents, and more specifically the father, in the way that they will then see authority in God. So you can say, well, which is it, the chicken or the egg? Did the parents teach this to the children, then the children responded in that way? Or was it something that was part of the child's nature, and therefore the relationship was built? I don't think it matters. I just think it exists. But Proverbs 25, in verse number 15, Proverbs 29, I'm certainly glad I didn't start reading that. It's the most embarrassing thing in the world to start reading the wrong scripture, and then you have to say, oops, and go somewhere else. But Proverbs 29, verse 15, the rod and reproof give wisdom. But a child left to himself brings shame to his mother and his father and his uncle and his sister and his brother. It doesn't matter to society as a whole. A child left to himself. The worst possible parenting style is permissive and inattentive. Just let your children go their own way. Let them do what they want. It is an act of love to put lines and borders around our children. Now, I want to read you something that I pulled off the internet, New York, NYU Child Study Center. I'm assuming that's New York. NYU Child Study Center, their website. And I want you to think of this in terms of the history of the church. If you can go back into the 60s, you can go back into a time when the church, in many respects, was very authoritarian. Very authoritarian. And then you can go through to the point where the church became very liberal and very permissive. And you can see the impact of the children, the body, in the process. And this is types of parenting styles. Authoritarian. Extremely strict parents. Highly controlling. They dictate how their children should behave. They stress obedience to authority and discourage discussion. They're demanding and directive. They expect their orders to be obeyed, and they do not encourage give and take. They have low levels of sensitivity, and they do not expect their children to disagree with their decisions. I'm telling you, I'm probably less sensitive to it than others are, because I came out of the military into the church, and I thought, hey, this is my place. Here I am, right at home. But that's kind of a flavor that was in the church. Authoritarian. Okay? Now, authoritative is a term. These are terms that other descriptive terms could be used, but authoritative is a term that is considered to be more balanced in approach. Parents set limits and rely on natural consequences for children to learn from making their own mistakes. How does God work with us in this flesh? I'm not talking about the like authority, the end result, the final judgment. I'm talking about how does God work with us in this flesh? Does he not set limits? Does he not allow natural consequences to carry through and that's the way we would learn in the course of making those mistakes? God does that. Authoritative parents explain why rules are important, why they must be followed. They reason with their children and consider the children's point of view even though they might not agree. They're firm with kindness, warmth, and love, justice, and mercy. They set high standards and encourage children to be independent. Not independent of the parents' instruction, but independent, to begin to formulate their own ways. Again, guiding them along the way. Permissive or indulgent parents, that's kind of like grace and only grace. That's kind of like the law is done away. Permissive or indulgent parents are accepting and warm, God's warm and fuzzy, but they exert little control. There's no real rules. It's whatever's in your heart. They do not set limits and allow children to set their own rules, schedules, and activities. They do not demand the high levels of behavior as authoritarian and authoritative parents. If you look at God, it's primarily benevolent, then permissive would be the child-rearing category of the parent. Now, I want to read another one from athealth.com because it's addressing some of the same things, but it's now addressing what are the consequences. Again, this is an opinion, but I wouldn't just throw it out if it was just any opinion because it's an opinion that, to me, makes sense. Consequences. Children and adolescents whose parents are authoritative being more of the balance, okay, rate themselves and are rated by objective measures as more socially and instrumentally competent than those whose parents are non-authoritative. They're more competent. They have enough boundary around them that they know how to make decisions, but they have enough freedom that they make choices as well. Since children and adolescents whose parents are uninvolved, the distant ones who walk away, that's the Big Bang Theory where God started something and never existed again. He's just off there and doesn't care. Children and adolescents whose parents are uninvolved perform poorly in all domains. Children and adolescents from authoritarian families tend to perform moderately well in school and be uninvolved in problem behavior. So you can be authoritarian and by and large your children are not going to get into trouble necessarily, and they won't have problems in the same level, but it says they have poorer social skills, lower self-esteem, and higher levels of depression. You know, I look at the church when the authoritarian was very much the flavor of the day, and then you take away that and offer somebody a little bit of permissiveness, and the boundaries were blown right out of the way. Those skills spiritually had not been developed. Lower self-esteem. I never really felt clean. Higher levels of depression. It goes on, and I thought this was interesting. Because we were discussing it in the car, trying to understand what the implication was. But it says, children and adolescents from indulgent homes are more likely to be involved in problem behavior and perform less well in school. All right, we can figure that out. Spoiled children, as we would say, spoiled rotten. They're more involved in problem behavior, they perform less well in school. But they have higher self-esteem, better social skills, and lower levels of depression. Now that doesn't make sense, does it? All of a sudden, you've got this indulgent environment, and they have high, as the world calls, self-esteem. And then I thought, okay, let me look at this. Because you say I am rich, and have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and you do not know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. So I thought, look at that. That's real high self-esteem. And yet, it is coming out of an indulgent environment because people can do what they please. So I think there is a relationship between the way we are raised, the way we look then at our parents, and the choices we make. And I think that relationship extends ultimately because God's the one who created the family, and He's the one who created us. And therefore I think that relationship extends as well to the way we look at God, and therefore the choices that we also make. When we look at God as an authoritarian, as a disciplinarian, in his primary sense, I think it institutes in our mind a sense of human fear, not a godly respect. And when we look at God as a beneficiary, a sense, or someone who comes in to help and to assist, and primarily to comfort only, then there is, again, a side effect to that. On the one hand, the law is done away, and on the other hand, God simply didn't do what he was supposed to, and we can resent the fact that there are matters that have never been addressed, problems where we have suffered or places where we have suffered pain. The risk we have of a permissive parent, looking at God as benevolent only, is really that of becoming spoiled children. How does God want us to see Him? Went to the companion Bible, and I pulled out the appendix number 4 under divine names. It's longer than what I can address here. But the Yahweh, the eternal, the one who was and is to come, when it translates that and adds words to it, God is saying, well, this is my name. This is how I want you to picture me. And it's Yahweh will see, or Yahweh that heals, or Yahweh my banner, or Yahweh that does sanctify. Sanctify means to be set apart for a holy purpose. So part of the names give reference to the fact that there's accountability, and part of the names give reference to the fact that there's mercy, that there's kindness, there's sympathy and support, encouragement. There is Yahweh send peace. There's Yahweh of hosts. Hosts portraying power, armies, authority, deliverance. Yahweh our righteousness. Yahweh is there. Yahweh most high. Yahweh my shepherd. Or God, my shepherd. And so it isn't just authority that is portrayed when God gives us his name. It is also mercy and kindness. And that ought to have an impact on us when we understand God in that specific way. How was it that the scribes and Pharisees looked at God? Matthew 23. What was their perception of God? Well, Christ addresses it, and he rebukes and corrects them for it. Matthew 23 and verse number 15. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You travel land and sea and win one proselyte. And when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell or the grave as yourself. You kill him spiritually if you could. Because you teach him to see God from your own ways. Verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithes of mint and anise, cumin, you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Obedience is pay your tithes. We're supposed to pay our tithes. But it goes beyond just obedience and beyond just judgment. It says the weightier matters of the law, justice, doing what's right, mercy, showing compassion, and faith. Faith is where you have a relationship to God in such a way that you can absolutely trust Him. Absolutely rely on him and put yourself into his hands. These ought you to have done and not leave the other undone. The law was not done away, but mercy and faith had to be added to it. Micah says the same thing. What does God want? To do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly before our God. You can't serve God without humility. You can't teach God's people without humility and be effective. You can't lead and share and care for each other without humility. It is a bedrock element that is necessary in that way. If you take the part of God that is justice and holds judgment and requires us to live in a certain way, and you add to that the God that is full of mercy and shepherds and kindness and watches over the sheep, then indeed when you put those together, you can then live by faith. How we look at God impacts the way we live our life in response to God, and we are supposed to indeed live this life by faith.